then she's been my sponsor, and I've always thought she was really totally cool. And the last time I heard her speak, which was right before I asked her to be my sponsor, I bawled the whole time. And I said, I'm not doing that tonight, so just forget about it. It's really awesome when you meet somebody who not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. Somebody who just really works the program so that you can see it, and not only works it, but lives it. And that's my sponsor, Judy, our speaker.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Judy. We having fun at Soberstock, huh? About a little bit more than 7 years ago, Virgil and Scott lassoed me. Stop. Coerced me into getting involved in Soberstock. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. But they said it was about showing people how to have fun in sobriety. And I don't know about you, but I didn't want to drink anymore, and I knew I couldn't drink anymore, but I still wanted to have fun without being pissed off. And so I was all in on Soberstock. So, gentlemen, thank you very much. It was one of the biggest gifts you've ever given me. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Judy. My sobriety date is Halloween of 1984. And I am a member of the old school group. Is there anybody else here? We rock, right? I'm happy to be here tonight. I have no idea what God has in mind for tonight, so we'll both be surprised. I'll be happy if nobody's sobbing like Leah did. I was really starting to worry. It was like she thought I was really pathetic or something. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is kind of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And when we were having this meeting, all these meetings that you heard Gloria, our great chairman, talk about, the subject came up about me speaking here. And I'm like, heck, guys, I'm no circuit speaker, you know. I mean, we've had circuit speakers here, and they're really good. I am not one of those. And then I went, heck, I'm not even funny. So, and Gloria said, well, you know, we were at the old school group with our anniversary board up, and she said, well, you got 26 years of sobriety. You must have something to tell us about, and tell us how you did that. And I said, that I can do. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. I grew up in a town called Appleton, Wisconsin. Go Packers. How about that Super Bowl? For those of you that don't know, it's football. And there is nothing, sometimes they say that Packer fans are rabid. That's an oxymoron. That's just what we are. But nevertheless, that's where I grew up. And my parents lived in adjoining towns and got married. And my father's family emigrated from Holland, and they became business owners. All seven brothers got together, and they became business owners. They were very successful and had four kids. My mom's parents, her lived in an adjoining town that was a little bit poorer. It was the home of Kimberly Clark, and most everybody in that town worked for the mill. Her father was a police chief, and she has nine brothers and sisters. And by the time she was 12, both her parents were dead. Her oldest sister got married and took in the children and then had seven children of their own. I took my husband back to see their family home, and I promise you, it was probably half the size of this room. And looking back at it as an adult, I wondered, like, how that really happened. It's really an amazing story because everybody went to work. They brought their money home. They put it on the dining room table. People went to college. We have doctors, attorneys, CPAs. They're educated. They're very hardworking people. So it's really a fantastic story of, you know, just really what you do when you're really in a tough place. But my mother was the second youngest, and she always said that if anything ever happened to she and my father, that the kids would stay together because they got to stay together. And family was incredibly important to her. Of course, I was who I was, and I didn't really get that until I was older. But when my parents got married, their first two children died. It wasn't until a few years ago that my mother and my siblings and I went with her to move the graves of the babies because she never buried the children. She was still in the hospital. So her whole life, she's 82 now, her whole life she grieved these two children that she never really got closure on. So 7 years later, I came along. And if you don't think that I was the princess of the family, I was the oldest grandchild on my grandfather's side, but for my mother, her dreams had come true. I believe that I was born an alcoholic because my father's side of the family had a lot of alcoholism. So I think that, I mean, she could have had like anybody else for a first kid, but she had all her hopes and dreams, you know, on me. And it was tough being the firstborn, but it was tough being the firstborn with somebody that had all that emotion tied to the child, firstborn child. She gets me, lucky her. Nevertheless, I can tell you growing up that from my first memories, I just felt different. I don't really know what it was, but I just felt different. Obviously, I was catered to because I'm the oldest grandchild on this side, and I mean, I was like the miracle baby on this side. And all my cousins, because of, you know, how many kids there were, my cousins are more like aunts, and they had to take me everywhere, so they were always doting on me. But I can remember, even from the earliest days of my memory, my cousins were in high school, and they had to take me along. I was always in tow. And in those days, they would go out to their cottage and drink beer with boys. And it was, I know a lot of you are way younger than this, but this was the days of convertibles, A&W root beer, and they'd bring the root beer and the french fries to the, you know, to the car and all that kind of stuff. And I would tell my cousins that if they didn't let me push the buttons on the radio, and if they didn't take me to A&W for root beer and french fries, I was telling Mama Marie that they had boys at the cottage and they were drinking beer. I couldn't have been but three or four. So I remember very early on knowing how to manipulate. So I was a piece of work right from the beginning. It's really not funny, is it? As I grew up, I remember, we had lots of family, obviously, and it was all very important to us because we had so many people. So the family was really involved in everybody having an opinion of and everybody in everybody else's life just because they lived in such close proximity. I became aware of my father's drinking probably around the third grade. And as his drinking increased and as life got more difficult, I remember the word chaos comes really into play in my mind. I remember a lot of yelling. I remember a lot of screaming. I remember a lot of fights. I remember a lot of uncertainty. I remember for no good reason my mother would just lose it with us. I remember those spankings just because. It was very confusing, and I just remember a lot of chaos. And it wasn't until I was in the seventh grade that my father went away to treatment. He went to Hazelden, and he came back, and he no longer drank. Up until that time, all my real formative years, and I was the oldest of four, I just remember, the only word I can think of is just really chaotic, and I can remember like shaking inside. I can always remember being fearful. I can always remember until I got to this program that I was always shaking inside. I always had a pit in my stomach, and I always had a radio in my head. And that's what life was like. I excelled in school. I was a cheerleader. I was all the stuff that, social people are in school. But in my sophomore year of high school, Mark and Michelle Weiss were in my high school, and they had an older sister, and she had a wedding, and somehow all the friends were invited. And I drank beer for the first time that night. I'm sure I drank a pitcher of beer. When I took that first drink, I knew that I found what I was looking for. And I drank that night until I got sick and I passed out. And I went, yes, I found it. I found the answer to my problems. In high school, we went to this Catholic high school, and we were naughty. We were just naughty. I mean, I was a cheerleader in a Catholic high school, and we brought beer and wine into the bathroom, so we would take breaks cheerleading and run in the bathroom during the games, during the basketball games, and drink. I mean, we were naughty. All my friends drank. And it would be a theme that would reverberate throughout my whole life. And somehow, I always picked the people in my life that drank like I did. Didn't have any social drinkers. I certainly didn't have any friends that didn't drink. Didn't trust those people. But that's kind of how we did it. I mean, everything we did around, just centered around partying. When I became of age, I came to Florida on vacation, and I never went back. We were here for 2 weeks, a couple friends of mine, and the first week I laid on the beach in Fort Lauderdale, and then I got bored, so I went and got a job. And I liked the job, and they said, it's time to go home, and I'm like, I'm staying. And I was like 19 years old, and they left, and I stayed. My daughter did that, I'd kill her, but that's what I did. And I've been here ever since. So I've never gone back. My drinking increased. And when I lived in Fort Lauderdale, I hooked up with these people. We had this, lived at this apartment called the Gaylord Apartments, and we called it the Gaylord Ghetto. And we had parties, and we had a good time, and it was like 12 units, and everybody knew everybody, and it was, once again, I just happened to be in the party crowd. I had to leave Fort Lauderdale because some of those people were in the restaurant business. And like the party began like at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was like right with them, even though I had to be at work at 8. I finally left Fort Lauderdale and got a job transfer to the Tampa Bay area, thank God, because I think I would have died. I could not keep up with those people. They were crazy. When I got here, I got hired as a banker and worked up pretty quickly into the organization. And when I was in my mid-20s, maybe 24 or 25, I was a VP of marketing, had $1 million budget, and I got paid to entertain people. What a job for an alcoholic, eh? My drinking, this was with clients. So it was a perfect job for me, and we all had fun. Toward the end, it became problematic because at some point the obsession kicked in, and I could not stop. And I had to be careful because it was my job. So when I would drink at noon, and of course, you know, business executives drink at noon, so I had to drink a little bit with them, but I couldn't drink too much because I had to be able to go back to work and then, you know, take somebody else to dinner and entertain them, but still not have the obsession kick in too bad. For the most part, I was successful at that, but there were a few, you know, 2 a.m. Mornings because it's just the way it was. I also lived in just in Manatee County, which is just over the Skyway Bridge, and I worked in downtown St. Pete. So I drove over the Skyway Bridge to get home. And it was right after the accident where there was only a 2-lane bridge because one span was down. I drove drunk a lot. And it's only by the grace of God that I didn't have an accident and hurt or injure or kill somebody else because it was dangerous. I had people in our community that I wouldn't drink with. There was one guy in particular that I knew for sure was going to be a politician of pretty high stead. And in my job for marketing, VP of marketing of a bank, basically you entertain people and you just do a whole bunch of community stuff. So I was doing all this stuff in the community for a high profile, so I knew everybody. So I did a lot of stuff with legislators, had access to about everybody. But and these were the guys I hung out with, but I knew that kind of my deal was, my promise to myself is I just wouldn't drink in front of this one person because I clearly wanted to date him, and I thought that he was going to be like maybe president, but at least a congressman or something someday. So I wanted to make sure that I kind of kept him in abeyance on the side. So that would be the person I wouldn't drink in front of. As my drinking progressed, I would work hard during the week. I would go home on the weekend, but before I went home, I would fill my Corvette full of alcohol. Just fill it full of alcohol, and I would stay home for the weekends. I would just drink. Go back to work on Monday and then go back to the social thing. One night, this group of people were out in St. Pete, and the guys that I'd never drink in front of was there. And I didn't drink for a little while, but then I thought, well, maybe just one, okay, then maybe two. And I did that, and then he left. I was like, yes. And it was one of those other 2 o'clock in the morning kind of deals. And I ended up down at the Yacht Basin in St. Pete with a friend, and it was the wee hours. And as I sat there on the deck of the yacht, I saw myself, how can I explain this? I saw myself up here looking down on what I was doing. And there was a very thin silver thread that connected me to that person I was looking at on the boat. And I didn't know who that person was. and I knew that I was dead. I knew that I was sitting there, I was talking, but I was emotionally, spiritually bankrupt and dead. So the next morning, I drove home and I sat on the end of my bed and I looked into this antique armoire I have with these big mirrors. I will never sell the piece of furniture. And I sat there and I looked at myself in the mirror and I didn't recognize myself. And I made a decision that I was not going to go anywhere or do anything until I figured out what the problem was. And I asked God what the problem was, and he said, "Judy, you are an alcoholic." And as weird as it sounds, given all the charades I had been through, I was shocked. I was totally shocked. You see, when I was hitting my bottom, I fell in love and I got married. And I married somebody that drank like I did. And I had made a reservation at a treatment center for him because I figured if he would stop drinking, then I would be okay. Come to find out when God talked to me that morning, that wasn't the case. So I called the treatment center up and I said, I'll be taking the bed. And I went there. I had to fly. And you know what? I knew about AA because my dad went to AA. But I didn't really have, my dad went to treatment at Hazelden. So I guess I figured, well, I guess that's what you do. You go to treatment and then you go to AA. I didn't know that you could just go to AA. Not sure that I could have actually because of how much I was consuming at that point. But nevertheless, I chose a treatment center up in the Panhandle. And on the day that I went, I tried to get drunk because I figured this was it. This was it. And I had my nice little suit on and everything. And I was drinking martinis. I never drank martinis. I was trying to get drunk. I had the car driver stop at the store, and I got a six-pack of beer, and I was drinking beer in the car on the way to the treatment center. I was doing everything I could to consume as much alcohol as I could to get drunk, and I could not get drunk that day. When the driver dropped me out at the door, it was after I was at the treatment center, and like a doctor or somebody in a white coat came out the side door to get me, and he looked at me, and he's thinking, I was thinking you were like the doctor yourself. You're going in there. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going in there. But when I arrived, they laughed at me because I had my workout clothes, my tennis racket, my racquetball. You know, they're like, where the hell do you think you are, girl? Thought it was going to be off for 6 weeks, so maybe get a little tennis in while I'm here. That really wasn't how it worked there. But I was done. And it was kind of strange because when I got there, I knew I was done. But they didn't believe me because as we started going through therapy and everything, they're like, maybe you don't really belong here. I'm like, oh, I'm sure I belong here. So I had him call my dad. My dad had been doing some alcoholic counseling, and somehow they talked, and he assured them I needed to be there. And then they gave me some psychological test, and they came back, and I don't know what it was, but they said, you scored off the chart in addiction, And we've never had anybody in any of our databases that did what you did, and I think you're right, you need to be here. So I stayed, and I made the best of it. I was serious about getting sober. And I'm a rule follower. So when they told me rules, like read the book, get up, you know, go to group, all that kind of stuff, I did it. And I spent 28 days there. This is the book that I got from there. All my friends and treatment signed it. I still keep it because it reminds me of where I started. And one thing that I knew at the beginning of my sobriety is my father had only taken one white chip. And I have always believed about anything, if somebody can do it, it can be done, that means that I can do it. So I knew that that could be done. But as we went our separate ways, my friends would call me and go, oh, I drank, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know we were allowed. They told us not to. They told us not to drink. Why did you drink? They told us not to. I think I was one of the very rare few that didn't drink. But I didn't drink because of the experience that I had. I knew that it was real. I knew that I watched myself dying. I knew that when God said, you're an alcoholic and this is the deal, I knew that was the truth. I knew it as I know it today. And so I did what they told me. I took those suggestions, and I spent virtually as much time on recovery as I did in drinking. And that was a lot of dang time. There are days I went from meeting to meeting to meeting. I did whatever I had to do not to drink that day. And it wasn't easy, because by the time I got there, I was doing pretty good. I mean, I had a big job. I had a house on 300 feet of water in Manatee County. I was driving a Mercedes convertible. I was only in my 20s. I mean, I had the world by the ass, and I lost everything in sobriety. Everything. And you know what? I didn't drink. I would go to these meetings, and in a lot of ways, the old school group kind of reminds me of where I got sober down in Manatee County, because it was just fun. It was fun. I mean, first of all, I was young by pretty, I mean, I was pretty young compared to when young people come in now. I love seeing young people come in now. But there are a lot of old codgers in there. I mean, it's kind of like Johnny was talking, or one of the guys was talking about the smoke in the room. I mean, we had smoking meetings back then, and you could only see, like, the bottom half of the room. There's a lot of smoke. And but the town was so small that on Monday night you went here, on Tuesday night you went here, on Wednesday night you went here. I mean, it's just, that's how small it was. So you all just went to the same meeting. So we all would go to meetings, and then we'd go drink coffee afterwards all night, and we'd talk about AA. And actually, I wouldn't talk. I would listen, because they told me I had to listen. I was not allowed to talk, which was fine with me. When I did get brave enough to speak, I spoke in a meeting, in an open discussion meeting, and I saw them all looking at me, and I said, I know it sounds like I'm speaking Chinese, but I want what you have, and I'm going to keep coming back until I can figure it out. And they just kept saying, keep coming back. That's what I did. I knew that I was messed up. I knew that I didn't have what they had, but I knew that I wanted what I saw they had in these rooms. And so I kept coming back. And I found a lady. Her name is Michael. Her name is Michael. She is 65 years old, and her father and her mother wanted a boy, and so they named her Michael. So can you imagine if you're 65? I mean, today it's okay to name somebody Michael. But, you know, 65 years ago, it wasn't. I mean, it was hard for her. But she had what I wanted, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said, nope. What I do is I do the steps with people. Okay, you do the steps with me? Nope, not yet. Okay. So every chance I got, I would follow these girls around. Well, actually, it was a group of people. They all got sober at the same time, and they all stayed sober. There's a whole group of us still sober today. And I would just go listen when they talked. And I was hoping that I would get it by osmosis. I learned a couple things in that early part of sobriety that was really meaningful to me before I did the steps. One was from my father. You only need to pick up one white chip. So I knew I could do that, or I hoped I could do that, or I knew it was possible to do that, so to put it that way. The second thing is Nancy, who is Michael's sponsor, taught me how to get and stay in the moment. And I use that today. And I was at her house in her garden, and my house was flooding for the second or third time, and I'm not exactly sure which. And I kept saying, like, I'm freaking out, my house is flooding, this time I don't have any money to clean it up and all that kind of stuff. And she's like, calm down, girl. Get in the moment. And she had me sit in that chair and put my hands on my thighs and pound my thighs until I felt my butt in that chair. And she kept sitting me in that moment until I got that in this moment, everything is fine, I was fine, and it's all we have. And sometimes I do that daily, yet today, to get in this moment and stay in this moment. What Michael taught me early in sobriety, before I did the steps, was when I would talk to her, she would ask me a question. And she would say, do you know or do you think you know? Oh, I know. I know. And we talk it through, and it's like, okay, well, I guess I think I know. I call her back one time. Yep, this time I know. You know what? I ask myself that question all the time today. Do I know or do I think I know? There's very little that I know. Most of it, I think I know. And if I only think I know it, nothing to do about it. Let it go. Not my business. So, at about 7 months in sobriety, I got crazy as, I don't know what, loon? Something. I was crazy. I had put the plug in the jug, and I went to a lot of meetings, but I wasn't sober. And I did everything they told me to do, and I was nuts. And I had to go to my youngest brother's graduation from college. First of all, when I was drinking, it didn't matter what time the plane left. It's like calories don't count when you're on a trip. Well, it doesn't matter what time the plane leaves, you can drink anytime when you're traveling. So I'm getting on this plane to go to Wisconsin. I don't know why, but when I went there, I didn't drink. What I decided when I was there, however, because I was so miserable up there, that when I get back, I will drink. I wasn't going to listen to my mother. I wasn't going to disappoint my father and have him watch me drink. And so I decided when I got home, I was going to drink. If this is sobriety, I didn't want it. With the full knowledge that I was going to die. I don't know why I didn't drink. I mean, I know because God took care of me. And when I came back, I called Michael again. And I said, I'm crazy. I'm doing everything that you guys are telling me to do, and I'm dying here. Somebody's got to help me. And she said, what are you willing to do? I said, I will do anything. If you tell me to push a peanut down Manatee Avenue with my nose, I will do it. You tell me what I have to do, I will do anything. And she said, now we'll do the steps. And I was willing to do anything. She told me to make three lists, read the first 164 pages, and call her. I did. She came to my house. We did the steps. In retrospect, I made a decision to put the plug in the jug, and then I made a different decision to get well. And I wanted to be well. I knew I couldn't drink, but I didn't want to be pissed off and miserable because I couldn't. I wanted to live. The steps we did. She came to my house. She told me to put myself in a bubble. I was not talking on the phone. I was not out there in the world. I was focusing on doing this important work. It was easy for me to admit I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. The second step, I didn't like the word insanity too much, but we did the steps with a big book and a dictionary. And the sanity thing in my dictionary back then said less than whole. And I could agree that I was less than whole. When we did the third step, as willing as I was and as crazy as I was scared to death to do the third step. I guess it's the insanity of where we get. Because, like, go on blotting out the past and to continue living like this or accept spiritual help? Well, let me think about that. I mean, really, what's there to think about? As much pain as I was in making that decision, I have no idea how long I sat there. But it says we thought carefully before taking that step, this step, and I sat there going through all this mental gymnastics for a while. Did you ever see that Harrison Ford movie, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where he's getting ready, he's got to get across that chasm, and he's standing there, and He doesn't know for sure, but he's getting ready to take that step, and he's going to fall like 300 feet if he doesn't get on sure footing, and he takes that step, and he's okay. That's where I was. That exact feeling the first time I saw that movie, I went, I was there. I know how he felt. Because when I made that decision and I took that step, I was on firm ground and I just kept going. But I was scared to death. And when I finished the prayer and opened my eyes, the hole right here that we have, you know that hole? It was filled like that. And I looked out. I had a house on the water. And I looked outside, and the colors were vibrant, and the leaves were green, and it was bright, and it was like I had never seen before. It was like a veil was lifted, and it happened like that. Michael came back the next day. She told me to review my three lists that she had me make. Don't use a phone. Don't go to a meeting. Don't talk. Don't watch television. You stay quiet. You make sure that the lists are full. Anything else, you ask God to show you. And we did step 4, 5, 6, and 7 the second day. I had written all that stuff out in 4. I needed her in step 5 to understand what I wrote in step 4. I still didn't get it. So I needed another alcoholic to help me see the nature of where I was, the nature of my wrongs, that thinking, what my part was, how I interpreted things. It was me. It was me that gave it the meaning that it had. It wasn't that everybody was doing all this stuff to me. They had their own lives. I just really wasn't that damn important. But I needed another alcoholic to show me and explain to me and have a conversation with me about really what it all meant. And I got it. And so when we finished the 6th and 7th step, the radio in my head went off. Like that. The pit and the radio have not returned. So we went on and finished the final steps the next day. I got to tell you, if anybody would have told me the day I got to Alcoholics Anonymous to write down what I wanted from my life, you can ask for the world, just ask for anything you want. If I would have written it down, I would have so shortchanged myself from what I've gotten. It's unbelievable. My wildest dreams have come true. It's amazing. I've gotten to do things in sobriety. I don't know. Did you guys ever not finish things? Before I came into AA, I'll never forget this. I went to St. Pete Junior College, and this young little whippersnapper looked at my ID number, and he said, "This must be wrong. This number is 100,000 past your number." And I'm like, "Oh, no, that's my student number. I've been going here for over 10 years. When I finally graduated from college in sobriety, I figured I won. Nobody else takes that long. I've gotten to do all sorts of things in sobriety that I wouldn't have even guessed. I don't know what you did Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week, but I was laying in the sun at the Ritz-Carlton in St. Thomas. Would you like to do that? I mean, it's pretty cool. I have been able to travel all over the world and see things I would have never seen before. London, Paris, Frankfurt, the Czech Republic. See things I would have never, ever done before. See 100 eagles at a time in Alaska in the mountains. Drink water from a glacier. See the sunrise. Carrie and Millie just did this. See the sunrise from the top of Haleakala. And you're so far up and the sun comes up over the water that you can see the curvature of the earth. I live in this kick-ass house. I've driven every car I wanted to drive. I mean, I've done things in sobriety. It's unbelievable. It's not the stuff that I cherish in sobriety. Don't get me wrong. I'm grateful. But it's not what I appreciate in sobriety. What I appreciate in sobriety, money can't buy. The obsession to drink has been removed. I couldn't not drink for one day before I came here. And it's gone. And it's been gone for 26 years. It has been removed. I have a relationship with a higher power. See, I thought alcohol was my problem. Alcohol wasn't my problem. Lack of power was my dilemma. I had to find a power by which I could live, which was a power greater than myself. So I have a relationship with a higher power today. That's unbelievable. I used to think that weak people surrendered. Oh no, I got a PhD in struggle. You know, strong people let go and let God. What I always wanted was to love and be loved. I have a kick-ass husband. Seriously. He knows about things in life that he doesn't have to pray and meditate and do that kind of stuff in order to figure it out. He knows the right thing to do. He is the nicest human being I have ever met in my life. And I got to be married to him. Still do. When I was a snotty little kid, my mother would say, "You just wait. Someday you're going to have a daughter just like you." And I put my hand on my hip. I can remember this. I put my hand on my hip and say, "Oh, don't worry, mother. I'm not having any children." My husband had triplets when I married him. It was my mother's happiest day on this earth. Gotcha! I got to raise a family.
I mean, I got to raise a family. I got to help raise these kids. I have friends in these rooms. I have friends. You know what? I know if my butt's ever in a jam, I'm picking up the phone and call somebody, and they will help. I know it. That wasn't true before. That wasn't true when I was drinking. But today I have friends. I have had the privilege of working with others. I never liked women before. Any women that, you know, before you come in this program ever not trust women? Had a little trust issues there. But today, the women in the program that I'm able to work with, I am so humbled. I mean, these women are kick butt women. They're just awesome. I have learned so much from them. I'm just really humbled to get a chance to work with them. And some of the guys in the room too. You guys aren't bad too, my friends. We have a good time. That's how it worked for me. I don't know if any of you are a visual or not, but I am. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just take a minute and kind of show you what it looks like. I know I have a couple sponsees in this room. Can you come up to the stage with me? If there's anybody else in the room that worked with me that I used to sponsor or ever did steps with, come on up here. I don't think there is. If there are anybody in the room that did steps or sponsored or worked with either of these two ladies, would you come up here? Is there anybody in the room that has worked with any of these people that have come up here? Wow. Anybody that's worked with these people? So we have... We have more. Awesome. But you sing very, very pretty. And do you have anybody that you have worked with yet? Not yet. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 generations up here. Now, this is just recently since we started coming to the old school group. But ladies and gentlemen, if you're new in this room, this is how this is how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Thank you.